Good afternoon. Last time we started talking about scheduling and starting with evaluating scheduling. We looked at this idea of when we're talking about what runs on the CPU, we can think of our programs as alternating between waiting for I/O and running this little burst of CPU, and our job as an operating system is to schedule that. And then we have to look at, well, how good are we at scheduling it? We could do the simple thing like XP6, but we want to know, well, is something else more complicated better? So we have some metrics to look at. We talked about metrics related to how quickly we actually are able to do other things. So with turnaround and wait time, where it's once we have some I/O to respond to, how fast do we do that? And like, what's the average across all processes and so on? We think of this as usefulness to the user in some sense. We have throughput, which is how much work are we getting done versus wasting time like switching between programs, which while we have to do that, is not useful, not something the user cares about. Or fairness, that if we have multiple users or programs sharing a machine, we want to have them run equally well. How do we do that and what would that mean? And we talked about some simple schedulers and looked at how they achieved or didn't achieve these metrics. We had our simple first come, first served and round robin. So first come, first served is simplest possible thing. Don't even stop programs that are running for too long. Round robin is like first come, first serve, but when something runs for a while, we switch to the next thing. And then we started talking about actually optimizing for some of these metrics, looking at shortest job first and shortest remaining time first, where there our goal was to think about turnaround time or wait time by trying to take things which will finish quickly and run them soon and let things that are going to take a while, you know, run whenever. And this gives us better turnaround time, less things waiting around. And then we talked a bit about priority scheduling, which is, well, if you have a metric which is importance, something more subjective, it's a way of achieving that. And also, we can think of shortest remaining time first as sort of a special case of priority, where we've chosen our priority to be the thing that's going to make our turnaround times low. So before I move on today, any questions on what we covered last time? Yes. So on the quiz, we asked, let me pull up the actual quiz question. We asked if we're thinking about round robin and increasing the time quantum. And we have a mix of jobs, and this is a key part, because we know like what happens generally, mix of jobs, where some things need to react quickly to input and some things are just going to take a while, what's going to happen? So is this going to improve turnaround time? And the answer is going to be no, because if you think of something that becomes runnable, it has to wait for the current quantum to expire. So at a minimum, we've increased the best possible turnaround time you could have on average by doing that for those things which are going to want to respond quickly. So we've made them worse. So we haven't improved turnaround time. For throughput, well, when we aren't responding to input and have long-running things, we're context switching less, so we've improved throughput. For fairness, well, we probably haven't done much to fairness, but you can think of probably our fairness is better when we have shorter time quantum, because you're going to run sooner. You're going to have to wait less in general. Everyone's going to have to wait less. Whereas when we have bigger time quantum, some people are going to have to wait longer, because that's just what happens with when you have to wait in line, someone's in the back of the line. And I chose the wrong key for answer D, okay, which I will fix. For is not more helpful to programs that need to react quickly. I think I meant to reverse that option because it's precisely the opposite. So I will correct that before I forget to. Okay. So other questions? Yeah.
Just on that last one where it was mixed, it's long and it's short, like input and output. Is that, would it change much if it was just like all long running?
The question is, would it change much if it was all long running? So the main, a reason to have that constraint in the question is that if it's all long running, then the turnaround time isn't really going to change much regardless. You kind of need, you need some things which can finish quickly, finish at all, to have turnaround time be meaningful. Yeah?
Sorry, can you explain again why it's more helpful for programming than React?
So it's not. That was incorrect on the key, and will be fixed. So it's more helpful for the long computation programs, because they'll get more work done. I think I just reversed that when I was writing the question.
For the remove question, can you explain how there was an offline one?
So the question is, one of the questions was removed because there was an off by one error. The off by one error is, I said A would finish at time 5, where if you count the number of cycles it runs, it's 6. Yeah?
Sorry, can you say one more time why, for the first question you were explaining, increasing the time quantum will not improve turnaround time?
So it won't improve turnaround time because if we think of something that becomes ready to run, with the smaller time quantum, it has to wait. You know, the amount of time it has to wait is determined by, is like the number of things running times the time quantum length, right? So when we increase that, we increase the amount of time you have to wait once you wake up to run next. And that's going to increase turnaround times when you have, as long as you have these long running things that are going to use CPU. Yeah?
With shortest job first and shortest remaining time first,
question is, shortest remaining, just shortest job with the preemption? For our purposes, yes, though the, remember, the computation for when to preempt is not the total length, but the remaining length, and just emphasizing that. Okay, other questions? Okay, so when we finished up last time, we were talking about, well, shortest remaining time first, we can't actually do that because we don't know how long things will run. We can't look inside the program and figure out what's this computation going to take to draw on the screen. We, you know, how long is that going to take? We have to guess. And, you know, we can't look at the information there. And we're going to use this key heuristic that, well, CPU bursts now are like CPU bursts later. This is our guess. This is not always right. In fact, you can easily make programs where this is always wrong, where you alternate between, you know, waiting for input and then doing a little bit of work, and waiting for input and then doing a ton of work, where this will be precisely the wrong thing. But for most programs, it's usually right. If I have, like, a web browser, usually it's the case it does only a little bit of work, whereas if I have a compiler, usually it's the case it's going to do a lot of work when it gets some input. So we can take advantage of this stability, knowing that, you know, what we've just seen is probably what we'll continue seeing, in order to approximate this shortest remaining time first. So this is how we can achieve our best guess at that without having to go into the program and, like, figure out, in this case, how long is it going to take manually. We just guess based on observing the behavior. We also don't have to have the programmers tell us. We can kind of just do it automatically for new programs that we've never seen before. So a common way of setting this up is that we're going to use priority scheduling to implement this. And since we have an estimate of time anyways, we're just going to use a few priority levels. We're not going to, like, set every different thing for a different priority level. We're just going to say the important thing is that the interactive stuff, the stuff that responds quickly, is higher priority than the stuff that takes a really long time. And what I'm going to do by setting priorities, my goal is to group things by how long their CPU bursts are. So in this case, I've made a decision that my priority 3 thing should need 0 to 1 milliseconds for their CPU burst, priority 2 should need 1 to 10, and so on. And what we're going to do is we're going to take advantage of this notion that what we've seen before is what should happen in the future, and we're just going to adjust priorities based on the actual observation for how long you take. So for example, if you're at priority 3 and you try to use more than a millisecond, we're going to say, well, we must have you in the wrong bucket. We're going to move you. And if you're at priority 0 and you use less than 1 millisecond, we're going to say, well, we must have you in the wrong bucket. We're going to move you. And this is going to be known as a multi-level feedback queue. We have multiple levels of queues, and we're using feedback to move processes around in these queues. And this is a common real implementation we're going to see. So a way we're going to do this is we're going to have those buckets, and we're going to enforce those buckets by setting your maximum time quantum based on the bucket size. So for priority 3, things at priority 3, we're going to run for at most 1 millisecond. After they run for a millisecond, we're going to stop them because we must be wrong. They must not really deserve to be at priority 3 anymore. And for priority 2, we're going to run for at most 10 milliseconds. After that, we're going to say, well, we must be wrong, you're not really priority 2. And so on. And finally, at the lowest priority, we have 100 milliseconds just because we want to eventually switch to other things at that priority, rather than making it infinite. But anything goes in there. And typically, in an implementation, we'll choose some way of scheduling processes within each priority. The simplest thing to do is round robin and just set the quantum based on priority size. But we're going to pay attention to when things finish and whether they use that whole time quantum they have for round robin. And we're going to make one of two decisions. So after we run that highest priority thing, we're going to say, did you use the whole time slice? So did you use all 10 milliseconds process A? And if process A used all 10 milliseconds, well, it's not supposed to be at priority 2. It's in the wrong bucket. We're going to move it down right now. The other thing which could happen is you finish early. In that case, we're going to guess maybe you deserve to be at the next bucket up and try that. So this is our simple decision. This way we don't have to measure exactly. And this is the multi-level feedback queue idea. So if it finishes early, we're just going to move it up. It's probably not going to move it up for next time. And it's probably going to not use that whole, might use that whole time, in which case it will just move down, no problem. You could imagine that this is not the only way we could take advantage of this intuition that what happened before is what's going to happen again. You can imagine we could use exact time measurements and try to use that. But this is a lot less bookkeeping and the code is very simple to write. Basically, we have one piece of code which runs when we preempt the process that moves it down, and another piece of code that runs when the process voluntarily calls the scheduler to run the next thing, which moves it up. So this is actually very simple to implement, and it does a pretty good job at approximating shortest remaining time first. Yeah?
How does it start off initially?
Question is, how does it start off initially? So that's an arbitrary choice we have to make. It's probably the safest choice is you start things off at the highest priority, because that way you'll at least run them to find out how much time they take. If you start them off as the lowest priority, it might take a while for you to run them. Yeah?
Does every priority get a chance to run, or is it only the highest priority?
The question is, does every priority get a chance to run? So this is because you're worried that things might not get a chance to run. Well, this is priority scheduling, so with what I've described so far, not necessarily. So that's our basic idea for multi-level feedback queue. And the idea is that in the steady state, we'll just be alternating between two priority levels if our CPU burst doesn't change. And if it does, we'll just move around anyways. It doesn't matter much. But the idea is that we always settle alternating between the two buckets that describe how long our CPU bursts are, assuming we have the same amount of time each time. And if not, we do something that's still okay, because we don't react too quickly. That's another property of this choice. As you could imagine, maybe we should, if process D only takes a millisecond, move it all the way up. In this scheme, we've chosen not to do that, and that means that maybe we don't overreact to some process taking a short amount of time. It has to take a few cycles around before we move it all the way up to the highest priority, which is just a choice that the designers of the scheme made, which is a compromise for how quickly they can react to a process changing what it's doing versus how erratically it might behave because of something that the process does once and never again. Yes? So I'm saying adding it to now, because when this happens, the process is still runnable. So it's going to be on that ready queue. In this case, when it finished, it's given up the CPU. It doesn't want to run again. So it's not going to be on these priority queues until its I/O finishes and it becomes runnable. So the question is not like where is it now, but where is it going to be when it finishes that I/O. Okay. Other questions? So the question is, what about the scheduler process? So the scheduler process is not a participant in this. So if we have an Xv6-like scheduler, it just gets switched to, it's not a process that's scheduled itself. Yeah?
When it finishes early, does it just go up one process or one priority, or does it actually like look at the time? And
so the question is, when it finishes early, does it just go up one priority? This scheme, the choice that this scheme made is it goes up one priority. It's not unreasonable to imagine a variant where you like look at the exact amount of time and do something different, but the simplest possible thing is you just go up one priority. Okay. So multi-level feedback queuing, so it seems like a nice practical approach of getting our low turnaround time. So great. And there are some problems. So a practical problem is, let's think of me using our, say, department shared machine. And let's say our department shared machine uses this multi-level feedback queue. So what should I do if I have some big computation I really want to get done tonight on that machine? What should I do to make sure that computation runs really fast? Yeah. So okay, so you say manually set the priority to 3. So that would be a nice idea. Let's say I'm not a system administrator because I'm not supposed to be able to do that. But there is going to be some way I can get my priority to be 3. Back there? Yeah, you.
Oh, set your CPU burst really low.
Okay, have really low CPU burst. So this is not something I explicitly set, but it's just a matter of how long do I wait until I do some I/O. So I can make my program run faster by deliberately giving up the CPU for a brief amount of time, by deliberately doing a little bit of extra I/O that I know doesn't take too long. I can make my CPU burst less than a millisecond and always be at the top. And as long as that little I/O I'm doing doesn't take very long, I'll get a whole lot more CPU time. So I just artificially add extra I/O to my computing program, and now I'm running a lot faster. Fantastic. So this is kind of a practical problem with this scheme that maybe makes it less great. And this is sort of an inevitable thing of these heuristic schemes which are trying to guess how long the program will take, that we can kind of adjust our program to take advantage of that. So it works much better if programs aren't deliberately doing that, but often you have incentives to do that. So I gave the case of a shared machine. Another sort of incentive to do that is, well, your web browser will run a lot faster if you make sure it's always at the top. So, like, commercial programs might end up doing this if you aren't careful. Okay. And another issue is fairness, which someone alluded to. So here I have program A. It's long computation, doesn't do any I/O, and a whole bunch of programs that are processing data on disk, and one interactive program. How much time is A going to get with multi-level feedback queues? So I want to give you time to think about this. Someone have answer proposal? Okay, yeah.
Would it be like little to none?
Okay, so little to none, why?
Because B1 through B1000 are doing a lot of like input-output, so it would keep getting high priorities when it comes back from the input-output, and then C would also like take priority as well if it's an interactive program.
Yeah, so if we think about our queues here, as long as the B programs that are doing lots of disk I/O take less than this 20 milliseconds between when they're waiting for I/O, they're always going to be filling up priority one or two. And that means that our program A, which has really long CPU bursts, well over 100 milliseconds, is going to sit down here and never run. And this is our old starvation problem we had with priority scheduling. So that's going to be an issue. Now, when there's been real OSs which wanted to do multi-level feedback queuing, and the cheating it usually hasn't actually been as much of a problem, but this starvation, this is a problem. And it's particularly a problem because the answer would be the same if A was doing a lot of computation and was about to do lots of I/O, because we would never run A to find out it's about to do lots of I/O. But it's just a bad problem. So often, practical implementations of this add more heuristics, more guesses. So they'll do something to deliberately avoid starvation. And one approach you could imagine is you track how long it's been since you run a program, and you have some sort of fail-safe where you say, if you haven't run this program for too long, we give it higher priority just in case. Even though this is going to mean that you probably are further away from shortest remaining time first, but it's commonly something that's done. Okay, so questions? Okay. So that's our multi-level feedback queue. And we see that we have this CPU burst assumption. You could imagine that another thing you could do is you could like try to have some more sophisticated model of CPU burst than this simple up-down tracking. Like you could try to like keep statistics of the recent behavior. You could look at what I/O devices are being used and make a guess based on that. There's lots of possible things you can do, and probably some OS has done them. We're not gonna like talk about exactly what to do, but they're all not necessarily bad choices. And something I'd like to point out, if we think of like policies and mechanisms, this is like we have this SJF, the shortest remaining time first type policy, and our actual mechanism is using priority queue, priority scheduling to implement that. And this is sort of a common theme you'll see, is that our real way of doing the scheduling is tracking these priorities, but the policy we care about is actually this shortest remaining time first approximation. So any questions about these multi-level feedback queues or other ways of approximating SRTF? That I'm going to move on to a completely different kind of scheduler. This is, let's say, rather than optimizing turnaround time, so that's what we did with SRTF, is turnaround time or wait time, mean turnaround and mean wait time. Let's talk about fair scheduling. I want to start with what's the fairest scheduler I can have? And one intuition for fairness is that maybe you'll say it's fair if everyone has the same chance of being chosen. So here's my simple, based on that intuition, fair scheduling algorithm that I'm going to just choose uniformly at random from everything which can run. We'll get back to this later. But it's fair. Now, if we're thinking about fairness, like this is intuitively fair, and maybe truly the fairest thing, but we would like to be able to compare things and say this is more fair than the other. And to do that, we need an actual definition of what does it mean to be fair. And there are multiple ones you can come up with. Probably the simplest one, which actually lets you compare any two schedules and say this is fairer than that, it would be maximum fairness. So we want the maximum of the minimum anyone gets. So the idea is that the fairest schedule gives the most stuff to the person who gets the least. So in this ordering, we have our most fair schedule, which is more fair than this case because we have less stuff to the least thread, which is more fair than giving most of the threads less stuff, which is more fair than having one thread which is really deprived of resources and the others run with the rest of the time. So this is one definition. And you can see from this ordering here why I said that coming up with definitions, like there's multiple definitions and it's not obvious, because I wouldn't complain if you said, I think the third one is the least fair of these, not the fourth one. But we've made a choice here about what we're prioritizing. We're prioritizing, is someone left behind, basically, versus is someone get really ahead. Okay, questions? Definition? So we have our fair scheduler, and you can see that if we choose randomly often enough, it's going to actually achieve pretty good fairness on average. So it's a good scheduler. Now, you might have another idea of fairness, which is maybe the fair thing isn't that everyone gets the same stuff, but there's some sort of relative importance. And previously, when we talked about relative importance, we talked about relative importance as the more important thing always gets to run over the less important thing. But that's often not how we really think about what's important. We usually sometimes say, you should run twice as much or 10 times as much. But we want to incorporate this notion that it doesn't mean that if you're twice as important that you never run. That's not what we want. So we have this idea of then proportional share. That if thread A is twice as important as thread B, then the fair thing to do is to run thread A twice as often as thread B. And we can have schedulers which achieve this goal, which we'll call proportional share, that everyone has a share they're entitled to. And the goal of the scheduler is not to prioritize based on the shares, but to give everyone that share, exactly their share, and not more, not less. And we're going to have an assignment where you're going to implement a scheduler which implements this type of policy, where we're going to assign each thread an importance, and a thread that's twice as important as another is going to get twice as much stuff. And we're going to have you do it not using a variant of our random scheduling algorithm, that you're going to choose at random. But you're not going to choose uniformly at random. You're going to choose based on how important things are. So we're going to call this lottery scheduling. And we're going to call it that because you can think of it as we're going to give each thread a certain number of tickets to a lottery. And the number of tickets they get is based on how important they are. So in this example, thread B is twice as important as A and C, so it gets twice as many tickets. Then we're going to run a lottery every time we need to decide what to run next. So in the case of your implementation, you're going to do it on XV6. So in place of round robin taking the next thing, you're going to run a lottery and choose a ticket at random and run that thread. And practically speaking, this means you're going to choose a random number and choose which thread you run based on the random number. And over time, this is going to achieve that B gets to run twice as much as A or C. Yes?
So if something wins, do we run like that thread for still some certain amount of maximum?
Question is, if something wins, do you run that thread for still a certain amount, max amount of time? So our scheme, we're going to say that we still have round robin with a fixed time slice. And you're just going to make the round robin decision instead of choosing the next thing, choose that, but then still, next time a slice comes up, you're going to do the same thing again. So it doesn't necessarily mean so it's possible that you'll choose A twice in a row, but you'll still make a new choice every time the time slice comes up. Yes?
Do you start your round robin over every time you find a winner?
The question is, do you start the round robin over? So the way this scheme works is we're not doing round robin anymore. We give the winner a time slice, and then we make a new lottery.
Or I guess do you look through your process table?
The question is, do I refresh the list of runnable processes every time? Yes. Because, like, most notably, we want to know, like, whether the thing we were just running can't run anymore. We need to check. And if something became runnable, we want to run it if it has tickets. Potentially run it. Yeah.
And does the order, whoever has the most tickets, does the order where they are matter?
The question is, does the order matter in the scheduler? And the answer is no. Only how many tickets you have matters. So if I can change how I assign the random number to a process, but I need to have the same amount of, same probability. And that's all that matters. And when we talked about priority scheduling, we saw that priority scheduling you could use to achieve like particular goals. And you can think of this as sort of an analogy to priority scheduling, but not for making strict choices, but for making these proportional choices. And we can use this to achieve a variety of actual goals. And in fact, we can even use it to approximate our priority schedules. So let's say this is my scheduler, but I really want priority scheduling. Well, I get pretty close. So my high priority thing, I give like 1 million tickets. My medium priority thing, I give 1,000. My low priority thing, I give 1. This is going to be very, very close to a strict priority scheduler. And arguably, it's going to be nicer because I can make this compromise where I say, well, I don't really like strict priority because things get starved, and I can adjust how much things get starved by changing what this ratio is. If I make it 1, 10, and 100, then I have a guarantee that my C gets to run a little more of the time. And I can like make this have this sliding scale between strict priority and this, you know, round robin, how, you know, somewhere in the middle based on how I assign the ticket counts. Questions on this idea? So this is the scheduler, as I said, you're adding to XV6. So to add it to XV6, we need some way of setting the tickets. And our choice is that the number of tickets you're going to set is going to be based on a system call that you're going to add. Also for the assignment, you need to count how long processes run, because otherwise it's really hard to figure out if your scheduler's doing anything. And what we're going to have you implement, we're going to not be picky about performance. So we're okay if scheduling decisions take linear time, which would actually be a bad thing in a commercial OS. You don't want that. You want them to be a little faster than that. But that turns out to be very tricky to do for a lottery scheduler, so we won't have you do it because this class is not about efficient algorithms for making random weighted choices. Another thing is that in a better version of the scheduler, we would not use the time slices, but we would do something smarter than that, like when something became runnable due to I/O, we don't care. We just want you to wait until the time slice ends, timer interrupt, or the process gives out the CPU, schedule then, that's it. Okay, so questions? Okay, so you might say, this is this scheduler idea. Okay, this seems like a thing I could implement, but no one would actually do this, right? It's silly to use a random number generator as your scheduler. And, well, it is a serious proposal by academics. And the proposal has like all the real details work out. So they talk about how do you do this efficiently, not linear time, and there's a way of doing that. They talk about how do you do this to make preemption decisions. So part of, like, if we want to simulate that priority scheduling, we want preemption. So they talk about how to add that and make that still work, make that work out, which we won't talk about. What to do if a process doesn't use a full time slice. So if we're thinking about proportional share, like we actually want to credit you extra tickets, we'll give you higher share the next time if you didn't use all of your time slice. We aren't going to care about that. We're just going to say, if you don't use all of your time slice, we're not going to give you any priority for that. But that's something we would want to do if we actually want to achieve you run twice as much. And they also talk about scheduling non-CPU resources. So this is a real proposal, and you're implementing a very simplified version of it. But it's an academic proposal, and there are some practical reasons why, if you look at real schedulers in real operating systems, they aren't lottery schedulers. And let's talk about one of them. So here, let's say I have two processes, one process with one ticket, one with nine. They just want to run forever, and over 10 time quantum, what is the probability A runs for at least 3? And note that from a proportional share perspective, this means A is running like 3 times as much as it's supposed to, because A really should run for 1 out of 10. Because 1 out of 10 tickets, what's the probability that we see it run instead of 3 out of 10? I'm gonna give you time to like try to come up with an approximation of this, especially if you maybe remember taking probability at some point. Anyone have an approximate answer? I don't expect exact numbers because it's actually a really ugly computation. Yeah.
About 5.5%.
5%. So about 5.5. I got about 7, but it's in that neighborhood, like 5 to 7%. Probably you computed exactly 3. And not more than 3, but it's about 5, it's like 7% or so. That's not very often, but this is probably enough to make this not great. Because if you think about, like, you don't want it randomly, your web browser with 9 tickets doesn't respond very quickly, is sort of the effect this is going to have happen. And that's not acceptable for most real commercial OSs. So that's the sort of main practical problem, is that this sort of, it works out in the long run, but we care about the short run. We care about, do you get your time slices soon? And this scheme doesn't do that. So another issue is, let's say we have process A and process B, and A is CPU bound, and B does lots of I/O. And our lottery scheduler is going to, like, let's say they have the same number of tickets. What our lottery scheduler is going to do is it's going to run them equally when both can run. And the result of this is B runs a lot less than A, which is probably not your idea of they're equally important. But that's the effect. Yes?
Could you explain why it was 7%?
Oh, why it was 7%? So this is a probability topic that I don't actually want to go into much, but it turns out to be a binomial distribution, which you can look up in probability, which certainly I do not actually expect people to be able to compute on an exam. Like, I verified my answer by simulating it, because at least I know I didn't use the wrong distribution, but, like, and that's the simplest way to figure it out practically, which people would probably do for a real scheduler, because often it's not quite simple enough that you have an object from probability you can just look up a formula and use. Okay. Okay, so with our interactive case, so one problem here is that the lottery scheduler has lots of variance. Our problem is that the decision I've talked about is when both can run, we make the decision randomly, but we don't take into account that, in this case, B doesn't get to run as much, isn't runnable as much. So B is going to run less than A, because B is never going to run when it's waiting for I/O, and it's only going to run half the time when it's not. So B ends up running less than half the time, even though it has the same number of tickets as A. And there are two views of this. One view is that, yeah, it's fair, because B and A have the same access to the CPU. It's just that B doesn't want it as much. Another view is that it's not fair. And if you think it's not fair, then one solution that works in lottery scheduling is that you can say, we should give B some extra tickets because it waits. And that's one scheme you can do. We'll talk about an alternative to lottery scheduling, which deals with both of these problems. Both has a different solution to this, why does B get to not run as much, and it also gets rid of the variance, doesn't make a random choice anymore. So at first, questions on, like, the alleged problem I'm talking about here with B not running? Okay, so if we think about what we want to do, what we want to do is basically round robin. Round robin was splitting the CPU up fairly, but we wanted to do weighted round robin. We want round robin where something can be twice as important as something else. So we're going to start out with that. And I'm going to describe a scheduler that's basically of this flavor. And in fact, it's Linux's default scheduler. So Linux's default scheduler is called the Completely Fair Scheduler, or CFS. It's not the only scheduler in the Linux kernel, because there are other options if your sysadmin wants to enable them. But it's a proportional share scheduler. So what it does is you assign, you know, your number of tickets or your importance to processes, and it gives them that portion of the CPU. But it doesn't use randomization. It doesn't do the simple thing of making a random choice. But in order to not do that, it needs to track a lot more information. It also has efficient scheduling decisions. So it takes, it keeps things in a way where it can do log n time to figure out what do I run next, rather than going through the list of all processes. And it has a way of systematically favoring interactive programs rather than, in, like the example you saw, of depriving them of CPU because they aren't waiting for the CPU all the time. And it also does something intelligent with time slices, which we've kind of glossed over. We just assume you set a time slice, and that's it. That's what we're going to have you do, is just have you use the same time slice for the lottery scheduler. But you actually want to be more intelligent than that, because sometimes you want shorter time slices when you have lots of programs to run them, you know, with low turnaround time, and sometimes you want longer time slices when you don't want to switch all the time and waste throughput. Okay. So questions on these sort of high-level properties, and I'm going to dig into how CFS works. So CFS tracks some information for each thread other than what share it's entitled to. And the primary thing it tracks is something called a virtual runtime. So the idea is we want every thread to run for its fair share of time. So we need to track how much has it actually run for. And the idea is that based on that information, we're going to say who's the most off what they're supposed to get and run them first. So we're going to figure out which thread is furthest away from having gotten its fair share, run that thread, and repeat. And we're going to determine whether you've had your fair share by tracking how long you've run, and not exactly how long you've run, but how long you've run scaled by how important you are. So we'll adjust by a factor. So if some thread's twice as important, we'll count all the time it runs as half, to make it have run more often. Now, a problem with this is that we need to do something about new threads. Because if you think about this scheme, I start a new process, suddenly it has the lowest virtual runtime, and it gets to run for a long time. Like, if my web browser's been running for 10 minutes, I open up my PDF viewer, now it can run for 10 minutes before my web browser runs. That's not acceptable. So there's an adjustment to deal with that. And basically, we're going to set some bounds on how off your virtual runtime can be from other things which are running. So we're going to say that if you're a new thread, or you're a thread which has been waiting for someone to press a key for 3 hours, you know, we're not going to give you 3 hours of CPU time because of that. We're going to give you some amount of CPU time based on you not having run recently, but not all of it. But let's look at things which are just not new, things that are always ready. So if everything's always runnable, then this looks like round robin. So here I have 3 threads, and I'm tracking their virtual runtime, and let's say they have equal importance. So in this case, we run thread A because it has the lowest virtual runtime, and get up to run it for 1 time quantum, and it gets up to 1.5 milliseconds. Then we say, oh, thread B has the lowest virtual runtime, we're going to run that next, get up to, that up to 2.25 milliseconds. Then thread C has the lowest time quantum, we run that next, repeat, and this ends up being exactly round robin. This idea makes sense. So this is round robin when everything has equal importance, and you can imagine if we scaled what this numbers, we'd get something slightly different with proportional share. And as we're going to see, this also is going to deal with I/O. So let's think about I/O. So a decision we've made by tracking virtual runtime is that there is going to be an advantage if you haven't used the CPU as much. So the reason we're tracking it like that is that we want to say that if you used a little CPU than waited for I.O., we want to run you quicker because you deserve the CPU. You haven't had your share of CPU yet. But we don't want to give infinite extra time, so the solution is we either keep your prior virtual time, or we limit your prior virtual time to a little less than the minimum of everything else that's already runnable. So we give you some advantage over what's running, but not too much. So the idea is that if you only are not runnable briefly, you still get your whole share. But if you're not runnable for a while, you just get a little bit of boost when you are runnable, and then things go back to normal. So we can look at an example here. So let's say I have a thread A. And let's say A doesn't use its whole time quantum, but it just goes to sleep and waits for some I/O to happen. So A runs for half a millisecond. And now it's not ready because it's waiting for a key press or something, or a network packet, and B runs, which I apparently have the wrong time for C. So B runs, because it has the lowest time in a correct version of this slide. And let's say after B runs, A becomes ready. We'll say A wasn't waiting for too long, so it still has its old virtual time from when it was last runnable, and now it's lowest, so it gets to run now. And then B runs, and it does work out if I just increase it by one. Then C runs, because it now has the lowest virtual time, and then A gets to run again, because it still has the lowest virtual time. So you see we're giving A this nice advantage because A was apparently waiting for I/O a bunch. So we want to run it more to give it its full share. Yes?
If these numbers, wouldn't A run twice in a row after B?
Oh, yes, it would. So probably I need to, probably the number I meant was like 1.5. Yeah, 1.5 would do the right thing, yes. So C to 1.5, okay. Yeah, so the corrected numbers here, this should be, C should be 1.5, 1.5, 1.5, 1.5. Now C has the lowest here, and then it has 2.5, and doesn't have the lowest. Okay, other questions? So the other possibility is, let's say A was waiting for I/O and just waits forever for that I/O. So we have B and C alternating places, and then A becomes ready, and now it's the most important thing. Well, A gets to run first, but we're not going to keep A at 1.5. We're going to say it gets to run an extra millisecond, but we don't want it to run an extra 50 milliseconds. That's too much. And the threshold, that's a choice we have to make that's configurable. But we're going to make some choice to not like let A take up all our CPU time when it comes back from a big I/O. And this is useful, and so the effect of this should be for something, if A is something which like does I/O, that takes a long time, then does a little bit of computation, then does I/O, this should basically have the effect of every time A becomes runnable again, it runs basically immediately. which is what we want for good interactive response, because it's a good approximation of SRTF for the thing we care about most, which is like, I press a key, something happens. Okay, so questions? Yes. That's our virtual time sharing. So to extend this to have proportional sharing, we just the virtual time by some weighting factor to specify importance. And after we've done this, we've actually achieved a scheduler which does a version of something which is twice as important as something else, runs twice as much. So another thing the Linux scheduler does is it needs to deal with how long do we let things run. And it uses some heuristics here where it's trying to balance two goals. So one goal is it wants to have a minimum quantum length. And the reason for this is that we don't want to context switch all the time. So they've made a choice that by default, they want to make sure that we don't spend less than 0.75 milliseconds before we switch away from a program involuntarily, just to not context switch all the time. Yes? How long does a context switch take? So the context switch itself is pretty fast, like microseconds. But the main cost of the context switch is that if we had like things in processor caches and so on, now they're no longer useful. And that's most of what we're trying to avoid by not switching too often. Okay. So we're trying to keep that throughput from going really bad from context switch overhead, but we have a second priority, which is that we want to have good responsiveness, that we don't want processes to be starved and wait for a long time to run. So we have this goal for how long we should wait to run a process. And the default setting is that we want to run every program every 6 milliseconds if possible. And that's a second priority. So we're not going to do that if there are too many programs to do that and not have a really short time quantum. We're going to instead make it take longer for the program to run next. So the result of this is that we either take our 6 millisecond window divided by the number of things we can run, and that's our time quantum, or we take our minimum quantum if that's bigger than that. So, questions on this idea? And these numbers are both configurable. I've given you the default values, but maybe the default values aren't good. But the important thing from our operating system design perspective is that we have these two conflicting goals that we need to choose some compromise between. So another thing that the scheduler needs to care about is what do you do when a program finishes an I.O.? When do you switch to it? And CFS tries to switch to new things immediately. That's something you want to do, but you don't want to do this so much that you're context switching too often. So they have a heuristic that there's some threshold where if the virtual time is better by more than that threshold, we'll switch immediately, otherwise we'll wait. And the idea is that we're compromising between these two goals. If we switch immediately, then we're going to respond to that key press faster. But we don't want to do this all the time. We don't want to end up having our context switch rate determined by how fast there are key presses or network packets coming in. So we want to limit that. So the compromise they've chosen is if something's been waiting for long enough, we'll start it immediately. You know, waiting for long enough versus the thing that's been running. Otherwise, we'll wait for the quantum to expire. Okay, so questions? Okay, so I've gone through sort of the things that, many of the things in CFS, there are other things the scheduler needs to worry about that we will mostly not talk about in this class. So one very important one is it needs to somehow work on multiple CPUs at once and efficiently. And there's a way of doing that, which is actually, you know, there's a very complicated design decision how you do that well, and we're not going to discuss it, but it's a lot of why CFS is as complicated as it is. And CFS also deals with some special cases. So one thing is we want to schedule related tasks in a good way. So for example, an example of related tasks would be if you have a process which is in a pipeline with another in your shell, you kind of don't want them to be scheduled completely independently of each other because one depends on the other. So that might be something a scheduler should take advantage of. And CFS also has some special modes for things where we don't want the process to get a proportional share, but we want it to run whenever anything else isn't running. So idle or batch is what they call those. So I gave you the example of CFS, first of all, because it's actually a really elegant scheduler that, you know, and that it also achieves an interesting scheduling goal. And it's similar to many academically proposed schedulers. So stride scheduling was presented originally as basically lottery scheduling, but without random numbers. And CFS is basically that. It's also similar to something you might see if you study networking called weighted fair queuing, which is basically the same algorithm, but applied to network packets rather than processes. So that's why it's useful to know, even if you don't care what Linux does, you know, still interesting. Okay, and here I have a little exercise. Give you a few minutes, you can check with your neighbor. And let's assume that these all have the same weighting factor. Someone have a proposed answer? Okay. No? So one way of thinking about this is that we have this limit on the advantage programs have. And the simplest way of thinking about this is, let's say that doesn't take effect. Let's say we just use the virtual time as is, no adjustments. In that case, what we expect is that each of these get a third of the CPU. So let's think about how that would look. Well, A really wants to have probably more, wants to have two-fifths of the CPU, and B wants to have two-fifths of the CPU, because 2 plus 3 is 5. So over every 5 milliseconds, it wants to run for 2. And here, this works out 1 plus 1.5 over 2.5, same thing. And this would give us 1/5 less here. So that's not going to happen. We're going to instead get A and B are not going to get everything they want. And they're going to run for about a third of the time. And C will get the remaining third. So that's assuming we have unlimited advantage for waking up from sleep. If we have a bounded, if we have less than unlimited, then A might run for less time. So let's say we only give A credit for the last millisecond of extra virtual time, then it's going to run for a bit proportionally less depending on how we set that advantage. Does that idea make sense? Yeah. Two-fifths, because A wants to run for 2 milliseconds and then sleep for 3. So ideally, it would get two-fifths of the CPU. So in it, for it would run the best with two-fifths and can't use more than two-fifths. And the same is true for B. Yeah.
Why is it one-third?
So because each of these are equally important, over the long term, to balance the virtual times, they're going to end up with the same virtual time, which means that we're going to evenly split up the CPU time over the long term. Does that make sense?
So then the answer is 1/3.
So it's about 1/3, assuming this limit doesn't take effect. And A runs for less time if that limit's important. Does that make sense? So if the limit's important, that means that after A comes back here, it loses some time it's entitled to. And that happens each time it goes to sleep, so it's going to run for less time depending on how much time it lost each time it wakes up from its I.O. And it loses time because other things were running, like C got credit for that time, got some time that it would have otherwise have gotten. Yes?
Is the loss in like portion of brain time, does that like go linearly with the limit, or is that?
So the question is, how does it scale? It's a little tricky to see because it's based on how long everything else runs, right? Because the threshold is based on how much virtual time did other things get. So it's proportional to both how much other things were running and how much time you waited. Yeah.
Yeah. What's
so the idea of the limit on advantage is when we talked about A coming back from a sleep, we don't want to give it 1.5 when it comes back from the sleep, because then it's going to run for 50 milliseconds and make B and C really unhappy. So that's where the limit comes in. So in this case, we've said B has a virtual time of 51, and we're going to let it go 1 millisecond ahead of that. That's the choice we've made. Yeah?
Can you go back to the question? I just want
to... back to the question, which is here.
So if there is a limit, then it's 1/3, 1/3, 1/3. And if there is no limit,
if there is no limit, then it's 1/3, 1/3, 1/3. And if there is a limit, A gets less time. So it's further and further from 2/5.
So no limit is 1/3.
Yeah. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So to finish up, I'm going to talk about one other type of scheduling very briefly that comes up, which is real time. So far, we've talked about sort of doing the best possible. There's another thing which comes up sometimes, which is we have deadlines, like from the real world. Like, I want to process audio with 1 millisecond delay so it can go out the speaker. Like, kind of we need it to happen in 1 millisecond, not 1 to 10. Like, or else we won't hear the right things. Or I have a cutting machine and I need to stop the motor at the right time and not some other time. Or I have a car's brake and engine control computer and I need to send the signals to those car brake and engine at the right time, or the car will keep going when it's not supposed to. And the schedulers we've talked about so far don't really work for that. So there is a simple way of scheduling for this, which does work, and that is to, is to use earliest deadline first. So if we have a bunch of things with tasks with deadline that come in, we just always run the thing with the earliest deadline first, including doing preemption to do this, which means that if we have some task with a come in with a quick deadline, it stops whatever's running. And this is guaranteed to achieve the deadlines if they're possible. But sometimes they might not be possible. There might be no schedule which does it. And that's just fact. So the scheduler uses this earliest deadline first. But if you actually care about meeting these constraints, like the break has to take effect, then in addition to using the scheduler, you want to prove that this can't happen. And you want to do that in advance. So we're not going to talk about ways of doing that in this course, but I'd like you to be aware of that. So if you come up with this sort of scheduling problem, you don't just say, oh, we're just going to use the Linux CFS scheduler and that'll be fine. And also note that it's earliest deadline first, which is not the same as any of the goals we've had. They all like might do different things than that because each process can have its own deadline. Okay. So questions about real-time scheduling? My very brief overview. Okay, so that's everything I have on scheduling. So here's my summary of all the schedulers we talked about. Under what scheduler do I want to choose? So throughput, first come, first serve, fewer context switches, response time, some approximation of SRTF. Can't really do SRTF. I/O throughput, same thing. You want to start IOs quickly. Long-term fairness, like not CFS, because it takes into account processes which went to sleep and woke back up. A short-term fairness, like for wait time, round robin does that, just like switch between. And deadlines, like real time, earliest deadline first, favoring users, strict priority. So it's just these choices based on all these types of goals we can have. So questions? Okay, so this is where I'll leave for today. So next time we'll talk about threads.